Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit with my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her.
Usually it takes weeks or months for me to bring a story to Yin Radio. Every Friday night is crunch time. It's do or die time. And this week I was running out of time to finish up the two pieces I'd been working on. So instead of working on it, I went to a literary reading. It was a reading I'd been planning to attend, having heard three of the four writers before and knowing just how good it would be. And I wanted to bring this material to Yin Radio. According to my time frame, in a few months, when I'd had time to sort through and edit the audio and plan and get it all ready for you. When I got home at nearly 10 p.m. after the reading, I was rethinking all my plans and timelines. My timelines were shot, and my plans weren't panning out. Clearly, the show was not going to meet deadline. So I did what any panicked producer would do. I canned the plan. With 2 hours prep and 10 minutes planning, I bring you today a most excellent show with excellent material from Friday night's reading, all packaged and bundled together in the topic of unusual places and stories about the people who inhabit them. This reading was at Lewis Clark State College's Center for Arts and History in Lewiston, Idaho, on January 30th. Four writers from the region read their work, and I present it to you in a fashion quite similar to how they presented it at the reading, edited to fit the time slot. This is Yin Radio, and the theme today is Unusual Places.
Travel so far, well, let me get myself back.
Installment number one. Debbie Lee started off the reading with an excerpt from a larger personal narrative that she's been writing. It's called The Origin Point.
I keep thinking about the salmon, about how their lives are all about going home to a patch of upturned gravel on the Upper Selway River. This home has been marked out for them before recorded history. This home is their origin point. I keep thinking about the spawning female, the way she roughs the gravel and drops thousands of eggs for the male to fertilize, the way she flips her tail over the gravel to cover those eggs. I've never seen a spawning salmon, but I'd love to see her leopard-spotted tail fin working violently and the water riffling above her gravel nest. This desire to witness such a thing is how I happened to be with the backcountry pilot Dick Walker in his Cessna 170 on an airstrip in North Idaho. Orofino traffic 8019 Alpha departing runway 27 and heading over the reservoir, Dick says, and we're off, flying low into the bullseye of Dworshak, the 700-foot concrete gravity dam on the Clearwater River, the largest of its kind in the Western Hemisphere. It amazes me, all that concrete and machinery and human effort holding back that water's weight. Its face is skyscraper smooth, but its size is menacing, especially from the window of our tiny plane. Once we lift above it, other things come into view. button-sized boats speckling the water, smoke mushrooming on the horizon. Dick turned southeast toward the 1.3 million acre Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, where we hope to witness a Chinook salmon run that dams like Dvorak have nearly wiped out. Dick has spent his life in the Selway Bitterroot as a ranger, a fire patroller, and a wilderness photographer. I'm in good hands, I think, though the only thing between me and pure air is aluminum and plexiglass. He slips a hand from the control yoke to a red knob feebly attached to the dashboard, and we take our place with the clouds. I tell Dick the air looks like an aquarium filled with dirty water. With a flick of his wrist, he tells me it's a controlled burn. Most wildfires are extinguished by now. His microphone mouthpiece rests on the edge of his lip. A green baseball cap shades his forehead. He looks to the camera dangling from my neck. "Open the window," he tells me, and I do it. I hear the winds whoosh and the plane engines moan. The world feels close, a world of sky and trees and origin points. I position the camera straight down and shoot. I saw my first Dick Walker wilderness photographs one morning as he was hanging them in a small cafe where I was doing a literary reading about my grandparents who'd lived in the Selway Bitterroot long before I was born. I sat at a glass-topped table sipping a cappuccino. Light filtered through the large windows, illuminating his prints, an Alaskan brown bear and a Selway moose, both in wilderness. But what caught my eye were the dozens of Idaho salmon swimming in a deep aqua pool he called Splash. Framed in antique wood, Splash was a little larger than a Monopoly board. "This time is gone," Dick said. I asked what that meant. He told me salmon don't get up the Selway River in large numbers very often. He told me of a flat sandy beach in the wilderness and swore me to secrecy. There was one small band of Nez Perce Indians, and this was their origin point, but don't you advertise it. Then his voice dropped to a whisper. "Those are spring Chinook, and for around here, that's an unbelievable photo. See, those critters are like this." And he held his arms as far apart as they would reach. He looked straight into my eyes, willing me to understand. "If you look at that image, you see that nearly all the fish have their adipose fin. That means they're f***ing wild. They weren't clipped at a goddamn hatchery." The night after the literary reading, I thought about what Dick said, how he doesn't put place names on his images, even though they're about place. How, when he said, "This time is no more," it sounded so apocalyptic that I felt scared, as a child does when his parents leave the room, afraid a source of survival will never return. And I felt a little ashamed. Here I was, living within a few hours of a vanishing wilderness, giving readings about my grandparents who'd spent 20 years there, and I didn't even understand why salmon in the Selway were miraculous. So at Dick's suggestion, I contacted a salmon expert named Steve Pettit. Steve is roughly Dick's age and one of his closest friends. "To watch those Chinook salmon spawning in the wilderness is phenomenal as far as I'm concerned," Steve told me when I called him on the phone one Sunday morning. "Every year," he said, "in late August or early September, the salmon lay eggs in Idaho's major river systems. After they hatch, they live several years in these river homes until they start dreaming of the ocean, something Steve called an urge. The ocean urge triggers huge changes in the salmon body. They begin the delicate process of transforming from freshwater to saltwater creatures. They drift to the ocean," Steve said. "A lot of people think salmon swim downstream, but they actually just float. If the river doesn't have enough velocity, they just don't get to the ocean by the time their bodies have changed, and they perish. That's why it's so important to have a strong current, one thing that dams like Dvorak have diminished." Well, switching from fresh to salt, something even more amazing is happening, Steve told me. Every water body has its own taste, and salmon memorize the different water chemistries of the river systems they pass through as they float 600 miles away from their birthplaces. Salmon are marvelous homing organisms, Steve said. After they spent 2 or 3 years in the ocean, the urge to reproduce takes over and they migrate that same 600 miles back to the spot of gravel. Tracing imprinted memory, he called it. I wondered if that was what was happening to me. Had I tasted my way here? When I came to this area a few years ago, I wasn't a 20-year-old wanting to connect with the wild. My urge came maybe from my grandparents who migrated here in the 1890s, from my grandfather who took up a wilderness homestead in 1921 and became a ranger in the Selway. My grandmother married him, I believe, because she'd been reared on the wilderness border, and it was her home. Like her and like the salmon, I didn't choose this home. It chose me. Maybe that's why I keep thinking about Dick's prophecy. This time is no more. I didn't want this time to be gone. And maybe that's why I wanted Splash, Dick's print, in my house as evidence of salmon retracing memory through ocean estuaries and river systems and concrete dams back to their natal waters. Of all the salmon Dick has photographed, it's the fish he calls Whitey that most intrigues him. Whitey epitomizes something mystical, something almost spiritual, he told me. We were standing in my living room looking at Splash because I was buying it from him. I had my fireplace going and it warmed our backs as we viewed the print. When those critters go downstream and go over the dam, they get all this nitrogen stuff in them and then they go out to the ocean. It's when they come back and get into the freshwater that they lose big chunks of skin. And with Whitey, the skin on her whole head, including her eyes, are gone. Dick ran his fingers across his own eyes as if removing them. I hung Dick's print, Splash, on my wall. At first, I was pleased. The image seemed so logical and beautiful. But over the next few months, it began to trouble me. I'd be standing in front of it and wonder what the splash itself meant. Was it the violence of spawning? Steve had said that once a male salmon pairs up with a female in a gravel nest, if another male comes in, there'll be a fight. So I tried to see it as a piece about sustainability and struggle, about the revolution of the natural world. But as I stared at it day after day, I started to see its internal contradictions. Some days the salmon look frozen, in a perpetual state of circularity, always ready to spawn, but never following through. Other days, the swimming fish looked airborne, flying above the water, not floating through it. Sometimes they seemed ready to shatter the frame and wiggle out. And sometimes it was like they were taking me out of the frame to what the philosopher Roland Barthes calls the subtle beyond, a place in which the static image can unfreeze itself and suggest somewhere beyond one's own viewing of it. I knew I had to see that place, the patch of gravel where Dick found Whitey.
That was Debbie Lee reading from her current nonfiction book project, Wild Lives, A History of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. The book draws on research and personal stories from a variety of people who have helped shape this wilderness. Debbie teaches English at Washington State University. Debbie's colleague, Andrea Clark Mason, read from her memoir that details the experiences she's had traveling the globe and, finally, making a home in the American West. It's called Continental Divide. Here's Andrea Clark Mason.
This is the introductory essay from a collection, a nonfiction manuscript I'm working on, and it's called, as Debbie said, Cartography. Certainly for artists of all stripes, the unknown, the idea or the form or the tale that has not yet arrived is what must be found. Rebecca Solnit. Topography displays no favorites. Elizabeth Bishop. In front of me, the globe spins. Can you find where your grandparents are? A voice asks. Perhaps my teacher, perhaps my mother or father. I point to the underside, the place farthest away from Philadelphia, where I live. When I was 4, my family went to Australia to visit my paternal grandmother and her husband, whom I call my grandfather. I remember being astounded that my grandmother didn't cook, and when she did, it wasn't well. My grandfather took us fishing in the canal out back. My grandmother did her best not to burn the English muffins she toasted for us. They took my brother and me to the zoo, where we saw a platypus swim through a tank. Families of koala bears eat eucalyptus leaves, and a kangaroo hop around with a joey in its pouch. My grandfather fed us tall tales of man-eating great white sharks and 13-foot-long saltwater crocodiles. Wild cockatiels perched on the telephone wires outside my grandparents' house in Surfer's Paradise, and farther off, the beach beckoned. We ate meat pies, bangers and mash, and violet crumble candy bars, Australian food. My parents left my brother and me for a week while they went to snorkel the Great Barrier Reef, where they saw 6-foot-wide razor clams open and close beneath them. A few years later, perhaps on my first trip to the American West, from the window of a plane above Colorado, I looked down on the Rocky Mountains. A crinkle, a corduroy on the earth. There was little snow as it was summer, but I was in awe of the range's size, beauty, how it seemed to ripple on forever. It was not a park or like the fields where wealthy neighbors kept horses near my parents' house in Philadelphia, where it is only time before those fields become home to big box retail. These mountains were wild. The town where my father grew up lies 2 hours north of Bangor, the most northern city in Maine. The schools still let children off for the month of October so they can help their families harvest potatoes. About every other summer, my parents, my brother, and I would stay in a rented cabin on one of those lakes. We fished, canoed, sunbathed, and walked in the woods. It was my first experience with the undeveloped. There were no strip malls, and the people who lived nearby were rural, used to knowing all the neighbors. It is the daughters and sons of those people who visit from farther places, Portland, Boston, or sometimes California. People still talk about the time a taxi dropped off a FedEx package for my dad before FedEx's area expanded to include Orient, Maine. In northern Maine, it is the lakes that dominate the landscape. We go for ice cream at Million Dollar View, and make my father name all the blue that dots our field of vision. Long Lake, North Lake, Spednik Lake, East Grand Lake, Chapultepec Lake. After my grandparents moved back to the U.S., 10 minutes from my house, they hung a map of the world in the family room. They stuck red pins, green pins, and blue pins in the map. I must have been around 12 when I asked my grandfather what the pins were for. The red pins are everywhere Grandma's been, the blue pins are everywhere I've been, and the green pins are everywhere we've been together. I scanned it. Even though all the lights in the room were dim, I could see the map was covered with pins. I could also see there were lots of places with a red, a blue, and a green pin. Istanbul, that's where they met. Like me, my grandmother was adventurous. As a third grader, she was the first woman at her school to ever wear pants, one day when the temperature was below zero. It was too cold to wear a skirt, she told me, her voice filled with attitude even 60 or 70 years later. Even though she was from northern Maine, her first marriage was to an army officer from South Carolina. After he died in World War II, she received a number of proposals from area Maine farmers. She said no to all of them. She raised my father, taught biology at the local high school, and then traveled to places like Istanbul and Cairo. My step-grandfather's money and equal passion for travel led them to Thailand, Fiji, and all over Europe. They regularly took the QE2 or the Queen Mary from New York to England. My parents kept hoping they would settle down from what my mother called their itinerant lifestyle, but they never did. Every 2 years, they would move to Hawaii or Australia or back to the United States. They lived for several years in a house 10 minutes from the one my parents owned. Then my grandfather became sick for his homeland of Australia, and away they went. At some point, they took a world cruise and left some of their belongings in storage and other things in my parents' attic, long after my grandmother has died. My grandfather uses a cane to hobble around his Australian nursing home. I am looking for a suitcase in which to pack my things. Was I moving across the country? Perhaps I was just visiting, making a side trip to Boston or New York to see a friend. Among the other suitcases in the attic, I find one I don't recognize. In it, rattling around, is a green and black striped sock filled with something heavy. In the sock are some sterling silver forks and spoons. I show my find to my mom. She shakes her head, saying, "God," and then follows up with, "I'm not surprised." You know about when they drove across the Washington Bridge with a box of opals on top of their car, don't you? I've heard the story. The opal survived. I can't tell if it's intentional that she's linking adventurous with irresponsible, wanderlust with scatterbrain. One summer, my father and I climbed Mount Katahdin, the highest mountain in Maine. My father woke me up at 4 a.m. and tried unsuccessfully to wake my brother, who had also planned to hike with us. We drove 2 hours south from the house we were renting to Baxter State Park, where we began our hike. We were equipped with a topographic map, several sandwiches my mother had made, apples, water, granola bars, sunscreen, rain jackets. It was a sunny, mild day, and we stopped along the lake to eat our lunch. The last part was hard going, up a trail lined with boulders, the cracks between just large enough for an ankle to wedge. At the summit, the wind blew hard. But we had reached our goal, to make it to the top before the afternoon storm set in. "I've always wanted to do this," my dad said as we stood in the wind, wrapped in every piece of clothing we'd brought. I felt thrilled I'd climbed a mountain in a state my family had known for generations. I looked out and saw a vista, all of Maine. It only made me want to see more. Right after college graduation, my mother, as a graduation present to me, brought me with her to Australia again. On the never-ending flight from Los Angeles, she asked me what it was I planned to do when we returned to the U.S. I said I didn't know, but all I could think of was the map of the United States and how the left side, the West, had so much more green, which translated into undeveloped space, than all the East combined. Perhaps I thought of looking down on the Rocky Mountains that by now I'd seen many times, all ups and downs, all green and white. Perhaps I thought of all the psychic space I needed to heal from college's difficult years, when my friend Summer, high on drugs and homesickness for California, would point at an African town, Libreville, on one of the many maps in our house. We both knew Libreville translated as Freetown, and we both wanted to be free. Perhaps I thought of how I always felt calmer in the presence of mountains and fresh air, how I loved to ski, how I didn't want to move to Boston, New York, or Washington, D.C., where most of my college friends were going. Although when my mother was the age I was then, 21, she had traveled with girlfriends across Europe on the train, our Australian trip was expensive and structured. I was impressed with the Aboriginal rock drawings, the crocodiles with open jaws, and our private flight over Kakadu National Park. But I remember looking longingly out the window of the bus at three women my age wearing hiking boots and backpacks. After we returned from Australia, I disembarked from the plane in Denver, telling my mother I would stay there for a while. I knew only three people there, but the longer I stayed out west, the number of interesting people I met increased and the number of breathtaking places I visited multiplied. I began to meet women who didn't just point hopelessly at maps, but women who could read them, tell which drainage we were in, which peak we were ascending. Over time, I moved from the gateway town of Boulder, Colorado, to the lesser-known town of Moscow, Idaho, to stay in the West and enter a writing program. All of my college creative writing professors had graduated from Columbia in New York City. I did apply to that program, but then withdrew my application, afraid I would be accepted and have to choose between an Ivy League top-ranked program and a state school in the West. I knew then I didn't want to go back to New York. One spring, to escape Idaho's snow and low skies, I visited a friend in Arizona. She and I piled our things in her gray pickup and headed out to the Hacienpa Wilderness. Everywhere there were saguaro cacti. We left the highway and drove for miles, winding around the sides of mountains with colors I hadn't seen in what seemed like forever. Senna and ochre next to a cerulean sky. then on a particularly tight turn, when all we could see was more green and red, and we hadn't passed another truck in ages, she pulled over and got out a map. I took her picture. She sat on the faded gray vinyl seat, her lips pursed in thought, her sunglasses covering her tan face as she concentrated on the unfolded paper before her. She is from upstate New York, but like me, she felt compelled to move west. She just spent several months working for the Forest Service, working and living next to a huge river, 2 hours from the closest supermarket. We were looking for a new wilderness area, much of it having just been converted from private land. We kept driving. The next day, hiking, we crossed paths with some ranchers and Bureau of Land Management officials on horseback who asked, amused, "You girls on spring break?" Of course we were, but the question felt cold, condescending, a reminder that we weren't the ones on horseback carrying surveying equipment. We were visitors. That picture of my friends staring down at the map sticks with me. We've both been to good schools, learned foreign languages, and traveled abroad, but negotiating a hard-to-reach, sun-baked, cow-riddled land that was never meant for women, especially young women who'd attended prep school in the East, seemed like a subversive act. One in which I was ready to take part. Although I wanted to visit lands I didn't know or understand, I'm not a daredevil like my brother. I never wanted to intentionally risk my life. I believe in bringing enough water, food, and warm layers, a guidebook, a map, if necessary. I believe in telling people where I've gone. There's a complexity in both wanting some control, a way out when the going gets too tough, an adventure enough to keep exploration truly that and not a walk on pavement or boardwalk. Perhaps being younger intensifies the hunger, the yearning for the unfamiliar. When an Idaho friend who was moving away gave me her topographic maps to our nearby mountain, I both mourned and rejoiced. I didn't need maps to the peaks and logging roads and drainages I knew so well. It was by sight, by sound, by texture that my girlfriends and I found our way around that mountain. Still, there were times when we thought we should be able to see the car, or one trail should have given us a different view. The longer I spent in the West, I learned through stories about how being lost can also be deadly. In the East, these headline stories almost always involve getting into a car with a stranger. In the West, they involve not being able to get to or locate the car that will take one back to civilization. I hadn't always been so adventurous. A nature lover herself, my mother had urged me to get out into the woods, but behind our house, there weren't enough woods for a person to lose her bearing. And besides, she likes arboretums, nature preserves, and parks, where there are trees and rocks and streams, but often a parking lot or road are nearly always visible. When we visited Maine in the summers, where there were enough woods to become lost, there were songs to warn us about how deep and dark the Haynesville woods were, and how, if they counted all the truckers who had become lost in the woods, there would be a tombstone every mile. Perhaps the song and thick mosquitoes were enough to keep my brother and me out in the lake instead of in the woods. When I was 14 and spent 3 months in Switzerland, one or two girlfriends and I would take off unchaperoned Saturday afternoons, where we would take a gondola or a train up a nearby mountain and find our way down. Although we heard of a group of classmates who had to be rescued off a mountainside by helicopter, we only found pleasant surprises: a cafe with good cheese, a group of cows or a few sheep, an ancient woman in knickers carrying a walking stick. When I came to Idaho, I met women who went into the woods to intentionally get lost. They believed the magic of wild places became more powerful when the trail didn't give you easy access back home. On our small mountain, this is not a dangerous activity, but it can make a person hungry, tired, and late for anything she was planning to do after. It was in this bubble of safety I spent many afternoons with these women, roaming trails and old logging roads, looking for nothing in particular but what we might find when we no longer knew where we were: a cedar with a hole large enough to hide in, a few morel mushrooms, a wild turkey protecting her young, and perhaps something about ourselves. We were ready to quit our job, buy a house, break up with a boyfriend, or get married. Last summer, a friend and I walked through knee-high grass on rugged land. We were out for a hike in Dartmoor National Park in Cornwall, England. Sheep were everywhere, but they thinned out as we climbed the gradual hill, at the top of which was a pile of stones. She chose our route, saying, "The path must be here. we probably just missed it. If we keep going, we're bound to run into it. We hiked through scrubby bushes and leapt from rock to rock as the terrain became more and more challenging. Gusts of wind threatened to blow us off our feet, and rain pounded at our face and sides. At one point, I opened the pit zips of my raincoat, yet the horizontal rain found a way to sneak inside and soak my fleece. Finally, she said, "I don't think there's a trail." She studied the map, which looks like it was made on someone's home computer and was encased in a plastic sleeve. "This is an overland route," she said. 50 yards past the end of the stone wall, turn left towards standing stones. We've done that. The next direction is go past standing stones and continue on to Nine Sisters Tor." She pointed to a pile of rocks above us and said, "Standing stones, don't you think?" Then she pointed to the next high spot, which also seemed to be stacked with stones. "Nine Sisters Tor, don't you think? Maybe they don't have trails here." I wanted a trail. I kept saying, "I think I found the trail," but she disagreed with me. "That's a sheep trail." She stopped to reread. "The directions say we'll have to ford a river later." Perhaps for a long time, I hadn't wanted any kind of map, any kind of direction. Perhaps then I was being led solely by my internal compass. But now, in another country, with the rain coming down and my 20s over with, I changed my mind. I thought hiking over open terrain with the possibility of getting lost would be freeing, or perhaps I would have found it so years before, but instead I find it disconcerting. Perhaps after leaving the East Coast, where most of my friends went on to pursue the lives we had watched our parents live, ones that had benchmarks and specific ways of measuring happiness and success, I thought I was comfortable with the alternative, the great unknown. I had left a clearly laid out path for Colorado, a state I had been to a few times for skiing vacations. I left that state for an even more remote place, Idaho, where I had visited once for a week 5 years before. I knew what it was to take an overland route. I'd learned how to get through, how to manage, how to not be afraid. Perhaps it was because we were in another country. Perhaps it was because I did not feel confident that the host at the Cleve House would send out a search party and not assume we were drinking late at the pub. The third landmark was in view, but by that time we were both cold and wet and ready to return for tea and hot showers. I am sure some of the farmers who wanted to marry my grandmother were nice men. They would have provided for her. She might have been happy, but it would have been a tame life. I wonder now if she thought it was worth the cost of not being able to see her oldest, dearest friends when she could no longer travel. Though in her final years she talked of nothing but Maine and returning there, she hadn't felt comfortable saying yes to forever with the life she had known. Like her, I wanted to see what I didn't know. I wanted to make my own map. Thank you.
Andrea Clark Mason teaches writing and literature at Washington State University. She read from her essay called Cartography, which is part of a larger work, a memoir called Continental Divide. This is Yin Radio, and we're exploring unusual places. All of the stories in today's show come from the January 30th reading at the Lewis Clark State College Center for Arts and History. Now, you wouldn't know it from this next clip, but Peter Chilson's story is based in Africa. You wouldn't know it because I'm saving the bulk of his reading for next week's show. It's a V-Day show. And Peter's piece is called Romancing the Archivist. Here's a taste of the essay, though. And in it, he's talking about Dante, the writer, the famous writer of Dante's Inferno. Here's Peter Chilson.
The 13th century Italian poet and scholar who helped define the modern travel story by introducing a guide, Virgil, the spirit of a long-dead Roman poet, to take him through the regions of hell. Dante, in fact, showed me a horrifying image of a library. "He led me in among the secret things," Dante wrote. "There, sighs, complaints, and ululations loud, languages diverse, horrible dialects, accents of anger, words of agony." These words from Dante's poem Inferno are not about a library or an archive. I make no distinction between them. I read them 27 years ago in a crowded urban university library reading room while sharing a long table with many people, including a girl and her boyfriend locked in a deep kiss. Their little noises attracted smirks, eyes to the ceiling expressions, bored looks. I was annoyed, jealous, really. A little lonely in my first year at university and trying to read for a humanities course. For me, Dante offered the illusion of adventure, of secret things in the stacks that would transport me to the other side of an idea, of life itself, and make me a new person. Maybe someone that girl might like more than her boyfriend, but that night I had to get past that kissing couple, like guards at the gates of desire and curiosity, winking at me while I tried to sneak around them, winking back. I had reading to do.
You'll hear more from Peter Chilson in his reading from his nonfiction book in progress, We Never Knew Exactly Where, Travels Through an African Borderland. The book explores how Africa is changing as colonial borders fall apart. Peter teaches writing and literature at Washington State University. Now we come to the last piece from the reading and the final installment on our show today, and it's fictional work. It comes from the featured writer in the group, Jill Widener, who has just finished a writer's retreat and is the recipient of a Washington State Artist Trust grant. Jill read from her novel that's in progress. It's called The Smell of Sulfur. Here's Jill Widener.
I'm going to be reading pieces from my novel in progress, The Smell of Sulfur, that fictionalizes my experience growing up the daughter of a petroleum engineer in Sumatra, Indonesia in the 1960s. Ferry landing, Sumatra, Indonesia, June 1963. The ferry landing is an iron platform that appears to the girl to be floating of itself on the milky brown surface of the river. Her brother points to the pilings, the oil drums, the tangle of cable and rope. The air is thick with the smell of mud, crude oil, the river bottom at low tide. There's something else, something spoiled, something burning. She sniffs at the air, dried grass, smoke, rubbish, molasses. She walks to the edge of the platform, listens to the river lapping the oil drums that are creaking beneath her feet, bumping against the pilings that are waterlogged and rotting. Hears the tension in the rusty cable, notices the worn braided rope somehow holding it all together. The ferry is a dirty white flat-bottom barge with a yellow roof. There are no windows. It is like standing inside a cargo container. To see outside crossing the river, the girl and her brother have to stand in the open doorway behind a chain. For a while, a skiff from the dock races alongside the ferry. The Indonesian boy holding the throttle revs the engine and waves at the two white children, but the ferry gains speed. The skiff bumps over the wake, falls behind, disappears from sight. The boy settles beside his father on a wooden bench bolted to the iron floor. The girl remains standing, watching the foam churn as the river rolls away from the sides. The river is brown, but it has a yellow smell. She wants to ask her father why this is, what it is, but she refrains. She asks too many questions. Everyone tells her so. The Guest House, June 1963. On the other side of the river, across the street from the wharves where the oil tankers are moored, a row of whitewashed cottages faces a tree-lined sidewalk. Except for the shutters, which are painted a variety of chalky hues, they are indistinguishable. Six white cottages, six tiled roofs. There is a room for each of them on either side of a long, dark hallway. At the end of the hall, a swinging door opens onto the kitchen, the dapur, as the girl will learn to call it. At night, the long fluorescent glass tubes attached to the ceiling crackle slightly and cast a pale greenish light onto the bare white cupboards and walls. Behind the kitchen, a breezeway overgrown with bougainvillea connects the back of the guest house to the belakang, a row of rooms built on a concrete slab where the houseboy lives with his mother. Mangun answers the door and brings cold drinks on a tray when anyone, even the small white girl, presses a buzzer on the wall in the living room. Mina does the cooking. The children's parents refer to them as the servants, though Mina has told the girl that in Bahasa Indonesia, Mangun is the jongos and she is the koki. The girl has begun to recognize the sounds of the night from her bed. on the wall the Chiuk of Chichucks. Lying beneath the rough white company sheets, unable to sleep, she listens to her brother's voice inside her head. They're house lizards. They eat mosquitoes. They can keep you company. Outside, broad leaves brush the screen. A door opens on the balakang. Through the open window, she hears the sound of metal on metal, the strike of a match, the hiss of a propane stove. Then the rancid smell that never quite disappears from the back of the house floats through the screen, coconut oil frying. Each morning at dawn, Mangun makes his rounds outside. He sets the sprinkler. He opens the shutters. Then he walks to the balakang, where he steps out of his rubber slippers and enters the back of the house through the kitchen door. The girl feels his presence, barefoot now, padding soundlessly down the hallway past the closed bedroom doors to the living room, where he tips open the glass-louvered windows to let in the air, which bring with it the yellow-brown smell of the river. The clank of the tea kettle against the burner in the kitchen tells her that Mina is awake. She gets dressed, unbolts the front door, and waits on the front doorstep for Mina to bring her a ring of pineapple on a small white plate. Mina uses a wide-toothed bamboo rake to scrape at the concrete footpath that the thick roots of the frangipani trees have warped and broken in places. Flowers fall to the ground faster than she can sweep them into a pile. When the girl tells Mina she's thirsty, the old woman leans the rake against the trunk of one of the trees and beckons the girl to follow her to the balakang. They enter the kitchen through the back door, the only door Mina ever uses. After she washes her hands at the sink, in a stream of cold water the girl notices, no soap, no tea towel, she wipes her palms across the front of her sarong instead, she begins to perform what looks to the girl like alchemy, like magic. Mina opens the refrigerator and removes what the girl thinks at first is a jar of water. Ayer gula, she says, letting a little drip into the lid, which she holds for the girl to taste. It isn't water. It is a viscid, sticky substance. She licks her finger. Sugar water. Mina squeezes juice from yellow-skinned limes into a glass. Sometimes in the evening, her son Mangun brings drinks to her parents on a tray that he calls gingeruk. This must be plain lemonade. The girl searches her new vocabulary, puts together the words for water and lime. Ayerjaruk, she asks. Mina nods. The girl wants to tell her that she knows the difference between the sour jaruk, the yellow-skinned limes Mina is pressing into the glass, and the dark green loose-skinned tangerines stacked in a bowl on the counter. She points to the bowl of sweet jaruks to check. Jaruk nipis? Bukan. The girl likes the word bukan. It doesn't quite mean no, but she is reasonably sure that Mina has said no. In Indonesian, there must be a family of no. Jeruk manis itu, Mina tells her. Jeruk manis itu dia, Mina says. And from the way she nods, the girl understands she has said something roughly in the range of that's right. The girl is sitting cross-legged in the grass, holding the glass of lemonade with both hands. If ayer means water, then what can jeruk mean, when sometimes it can be a tangerine and sometimes a lime? Maybe manis means sweet and nipis means sour, or maybe nipis means small. Maybe nipis means small and sour with a tight, thin skin that is sometimes yellow and sometimes green. Maybe in Indonesian a single word can mean all of those things. Mina, whose body is old and not much bigger than the 7-year-old girl's, is squatting now on bare flat feet beside the frangipani tree. Her sarong has been washed so many times that the color is nearly gone from the fabric. But what fascinates the girl most of all, besides the way she is able to tie her long gray hair into a knot at the back of her head with the twist of her wrist, are the circles of flesh, large as coins, missing from the lobes of her ears. Mina breaks a stem from a frangipani leaf. Sticky milk oozes out. She places one of the flowers on the girl's shoulder, who watches mesmerized as Mina lifts her arm. Then, as if she has commanded it to do so, the flower cartwheels end over end to the girl's wrist, which Mina turns over at just the right moment for the flower to fall into the palm of her hand. Behind the guest house, July 1963. Mina's sitting on the floor in the shade of the breezeway that connects the kitchen to the row of rooms the white girl's parents call the servants' quarters. That isn't what it's called. It's called the balakang, Mina told me. Maybe you shouldn't go inside their rooms, Elizabeth. Mina likes me to visit her. She likes to tell me things. She likes to show me things. Mina's mouth is stained bright red. What looks to the girl like a slick-skinned, fibrous nut is lodged between her gums and her cheek, packed there so that the side of her face looks swollen. She is chewing, and her lips and her teeth and the spaces in between her teeth are coated with red-brown saliva and bits of what look like masticated bark. From time to time, she reaches into her mouth, removes the partially chewed wad, and spits into the dirt between her feet. Some of the juice she swallows, some of it she holds in her cheek. She spits again and returns the chewed net to her mouth. Fina, the Filipino girl who lives down the road, is showing Elizabeth how to make a necklace from the purple stem of the ubi plant that grows in the dirt against a concrete wall. Elizabeth is trying to imitate the way Fina snaps the stem so that she can strip the skin in a stair-step pattern, but her stem keeps breaking and she has to begin again. What is ubi? Something like potato, Indonesian potato. Elizabeth is distracted by what Mina is doing. She knows it isn't blood that Mina is spitting, but it looks like blood. Her eyes are distant. She has stopped talking. What is she eating? She isn't eating. She's chewing. You know the short palm trees that grow along the river wall in Kampung Baru? The ones near the new pool? Fina nods. It is betel nut, the fruit of the betel palm. Old women like it. Why? Fina shrugs. Maybe it is something like medicine. Elizabeth likes Fina's voice. It is soft, quiet, and husky at the same time, like a boy's voice. I think it makes them dream while they are awake, Fina says. Do you remember your dreams? Elizabeth pauses to think. Do you? Yes, Fina looks at her. I've dreamed of you. You have? I saw you inside my house. I've never been to your house. You must have, or else you will. That's how it is with dreams. Everything has already happened, or else it will happen. How do you know? I just know. What was I doing? Nothing, just standing there, in the kitchen, I think. You looked afraid. I think you were afraid you were going to have to eat our food. Have you ever played tennis? No. It is fun to go to the courts at night, especially if the moon is out, and it will be tonight. You can use my sister's racket. Do you want to? Fina is kneeling on the kitchen floor, retying the laces of her tennis shoes when she remembers the tennis rackets. Elizabeth waits on the back step, the screen door propped open on her elbow. As she enters the kitchen, she smells something scorched. The rancid smell is like a residue hanging in the air, a film coating all of the surfaces in the room. Then she remembers the smell that comes from the belakang when Mina cooks on the propane stove. From the other side of the room, the Indonesian cook turns around, less to look at the white girl than at the door she is holding open. She says nothing, turns back to the dishes she is washing in the sink. Elizabeth glances through the glass louvers that are tilted open, high on the wall near the ceiling. The twilight is gone from the sky. It is dark now. From a room at the front of the house, she hears a radio. She looks around the room. Paper ornaments dangle from the ceiling. They swing in the breeze from the fan. On the wall, a calendar. A barefoot, bare-chested white boy with a white blonde hair stares from the photograph for the month of July. His shorts are loose and long. A white feathered cockatoo with a yellow comb is balanced on his shoulder. Fina is back. She hands one of the rackets to the girl. The screen door slams behind them and they're walking in the dark down the gravel road toward the tennis courts. Across the street from the courts, a diving board and the deck of a swimming pool are visible behind a tall wire fence. Elizabeth's brother and his friends call it the old pool. She hears her brother's voice in her head as they pass. No one swims in the old pool. Look at the tile. Look at the water. It smells like the swamp. Elizabeth's mother uses the word physique to describe the nice-looking bodies of boys. Your brother has a nice physique, she says. This is the word Elizabeth thinks of, watching Fina crouched, boy-like, on half-bent knees behind the net. Long, strong arms and legs, long, strong waist and back. Her long black hair and the attitude of her shoulders makes the girl think of the broad, confident strokes of a magic marker across a sheet of brown construction paper. Fina has a nice physique, she thinks. Watch, Fina says, like this. Grasp the racket here as though you want to shake its hand. From her crouch, in slow motion, she steps back and swings back her arm. Unlock the door, close the door, turn the key. You try. Fina is older than Elizabeth. She might be 11. She might be 12. Let's climb on the roof, she says. Fina leads Elizabeth behind the building, where an open concrete staircase leads to a flat roof. It is dark on the roof. I like to sit in the dark, Fina says. Do you? I don't know. Are you afraid? I don't know. You don't have to be. I come here with my sister all the time. No one ever comes up here, only us. Fina finds a place that looks clean enough and sits down. She brushes the concrete floor with her hand and pats the ground. Elizabeth sits down beside her. Fina leans back against the concrete wall, her long bare legs stretched out in front of her. Look, Fina says. She points through the branches of a monkey pod tree. I told you. The moon is a yellow-brown disk that appears to be rising out of the river. Can you smell the river? Elizabeth sniffs at the air. Have you ever noticed there is more to smell in the dark? Elizabeth hasn't, but recognizes now that it is true. Fina unties her tennis shoes and pulls them off. Take off your shoes. Barefoot feels better. Elizabeth pulls off her shoes and socks. She scuffs the soles of her feet against the floor. I remembered something else about the dream. Hours have gone by. Elizabeth has forgotten the dream. You climbed under a table. Do you like horses? Why? There was a herd of horses under the table. Really small horses. Maybe they were dogs, but I think they were horses. Their faces were long like horses. You were explaining the best way to approach a shy animal. You put out your hand. You said, you have to wait for them to come to you. Then you said, well, usually this works, unless they bite. Something like that. Unless they bite. Something like that. You dreamed that much about me? Fina nods. Fina is watching the moon, her shoulders and head propped against the wall. Elizabeth is sitting cross-legged beside her, barefoot in a loose pair of shorts. Lie down like me. Elizabeth is relaxed now. Your legs are longer than mine. Fina moves closer until the side of her brown leg is touching the side of the white girl's leg, longer by a lot. Fina lifts her foot, rests it on top of Elizabeth's ankle. Elizabeth doesn't move. Fina lifts her hand, rests it on the white girl's hip. Elizabeth doesn't move. Look at the moon, Fina says. Gilang chimerlang. Fina's voice is soft. It sounds the way it always sounds, quiet and husky at the same time, like a boy's voice. What did you say? Gilang chimerlang, the moon. It's so glittery. It is so bright. Fina moves her hand back and forth against Elizabeth's hip bone. Elizabeth doesn't move. Fina's hand rests. Elizabeth hears herself swallow. The tips of Fina's fingers move back and forth against the rough cotton fabric of Elizabeth's shorts. Her fingers reach for the hem. Fina's fingers play with the hem of Elizabeth's shorts. Elizabeth doesn't move. Fina's foot moves. The heel of her bare foot rubs against Elizabeth's bare ankle. The tips of her fingers slide to Elizabeth's knee. Elizabeth watches Fina's toes. It is as if they're breathing. It is as if they are speaking or singing. Fina's hand stops moving. Her toes lie still. It is as if they've gone to sleep. The moon hangs over their heads, more yellow now than brown. Fina sits up. She lifts her long black hair off the back of her neck, shakes it away from her shoulders. Feels good, she says. She looks at Elizabeth. Have you ever tried that before? The white girl shakes her head. You have your racket? Yes. Let's run.
That was Jill Widener reading from her novel In Progress, The Smell of Sulfur. Jill teaches English at Yakima Valley Community College. That wraps up our Yin Radio show today, which came from Lewis Clark State College's Center for Arts and History in Lewiston, Idaho, on January 30th. The writers left that reading to head for the slopes, and I wish them all very happy skiing. Now, before I go, here's a bit from Blood Ruby's original song, The Edge of the Map.
When I was a child, I got lost in the woods. With my father, our best guesses failed. We wound up on a trail with no markers. My little lamb, the best laid plans. Sometimes.
If you want to hear past shows of Yin Radio or podcast this show, you can do that at yinradio.org. That's yinradio.org. And that's where you can sign up for our electronic newsletter to find out what's going on at Yin Radio and what's coming up on Yin Radio. And you can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and Facebook. You can hear Yin Radio on KYRS 89.9 and 92.3 FM, Thin Air Radio in Spokane, Washington. Also on KSOW in Cottage Grove, Oregon. And WETX in Johnson City, also known as The Detour, the voice of Appalachia, among other fine community stations. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. That's V as in voice, P as in power, Foundation. And hey, you can drop us a note at yinradio@vpfound.org. Again, remember that's V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. I am your producer and host, Sandy Billings, and I'm glad you joined me. Until next week.